Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host, and we've got 2 hours of open forum for you today. You're welcome to call with any question at all. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Second hour, Jim Blackburn will be here. This hour, Jimmy Akin. Hello, Jimmy.
Hello, Cy Kelly.
I'm glad to have you here, Jimmy. Thanks for doing it. I noticed that you have a test of your psychic powers on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Well, yeah. So last Friday, Dom and I did some tests that in principle could reveal psychic functioning. And yeah. We did that to let people have an example of the kind of things that parapsychologists have to consider when they're performing tests. So
it's got
some
fun twists in it. I think people will enjoy listening to it. That's a Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. What drops tomorrow?
Tomorrow is the case of the Greenbrier Ghost, which is from the it's from the 1890s. It's a case in West Virginia where a woman was murdered, came back, and testified against her own killer, and the testimony was admitted in court.
No way! Yep. I gotta watch this one. You can find Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World just by typing in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. I think it's fantastic that it's now got more than 70,000 subscribers. I mean, come on. So you should be one, too.
Actually, the latest numbers I saw suggest it's got over 80,000 listeners per episode
Nice. Yeah. You're starting to reach critical mass. Then they'll tell two friends and they'll tell two friends.
They have a name for that in nuclear physics.
Reaction?
Chain reaction,
yeah. 888-318-7884. You know that when Jimmy's here, you can ask the whole range of questions, even if they're not quite, religious. You can ask moral questions, philosophical questions, even scientific questions. One of the things that a lot of folks want to ask about is the intersection of science and religion. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH.
Also, want to mention I'm scheduled to be on the show again tomorrow for an hour of weird questions. So if people have any weird questions they want to ask, now would be a good time to send them to radio@catholic.com.
Oh, yes. Do send your weird questions. And occasionally we get the person who says, this is probably too weird. Nope, it's not. We haven't gotten the too weird of a question yet. So go ahead and send it to radio@catholic.com. Already lines filling up as they do with Jimmy, but you are welcome to call. Let me just check how many lines are open right now. There's still a couple lines open. 888-318-7884. Let's head down to Tampa, Florida, where Andrew is watching on YouTube. Andrew, thanks for getting us started. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, it's Mr. Akin. My question is, why do we see the Diocese of Rome, even though it has the qualifications of an archdiocese and is a premier seat of the church?
Oh,
not sure I heard everything Andrew said.
Andrew, it could be the phones again. We've been having these little glitches, but it sounded a little choppy. Are you saying why we don't call Rome an archdiocese? Why do we call it a diocese?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, so I would have to investigate whether the term diocese is actually used. I mean, I'm just going off the top of my head. Normally, when people talk about Rome, they'll say things like the Vatican or the Holy See or the Apostolic See. If they want to, however, those terms tend to have a global connotation. And if you want to refer to, no, I'm just talking about the Catholics in and around the city of Rome and that local church, then I have heard people, you know, casually describe it as the Diocese of Rome, but I don't know off the top of my head if that's an official designation. One way or another, whether it's an official or unofficial designation, it's the same basic answer as any question about why is the language the way it is. That's just the way the language grew up. Language evolves organically without people consciously thinking about it most of the time. And so unless there's a special reason why a particular term gets crafted in a kind of technical way, it's going to end up just organically being whatever people decide to call it. And so to the extent that people call the Diocese of Rome the Diocese of Rome, it's simply because that's what they're used to doing. And we shouldn't look too deeply. It's kind of like, you know, why is Sykehlet called Sykehlet? Well, because that's what his parents decided to call him, you know, and there's not too much more deeper than that in terms of why do we call any particular thing by its name.
Andrew, thanks. I'm going to keep going, and I just want to let the callers know, maybe just get to your question as quickly as you can, because we have been having these phone troubles this week, and we think we located the problem, but it sounded a little choppy with Andrew. So just ask your question as quickly as you can. We'll go to Connor in Seaport, Louisiana, listening on the Catholic Answers podcast. That must be at catholic.com. Go ahead, Andrew, with your question for Jimmy.
Am I the right person? My name's Connor.
Do I have the wrong name, perhaps? But Connor, go ahead. Oh, yes, that was me, Connor. I just said the wrong name. And now, okay, go ahead, Facebook. Have at it. The Facebook folks will pick on me now. I said the wrong name. Sorry, Connor. Go ahead.
That's all right, sir. I just wanted to ask, are there any secular arguments for the existence of human dignity?
Well, there are. They're going to appeal basically to human intuition. And the reason for that is because dignity is a moral quality. It's not something that can be measured scientifically. There's no way that you can do laboratory tests that will reveal the moral quality of an act or a person. There's no way to, you know, measure goodness or evil in a test tube. And so good and evil and related concepts like dignity are non-empirical. They're things that we can't detect with the senses and we can't measure. And as a result, we're going to have to appeal to human intuition for those things. And many people who are secular are prepared to do that. They're prepared to acknowledge that good and evil is real and that concepts like dignity are meaningful and that our intuitions can tell us about them. On the other hand, there are other people who want to say it's all just atoms and void and there is no ultimate meaning in the world. And those people have closed themselves off to the intuitions that they have. Because the truth is, these intuitions are built into all of us. And even people who claim that there's no objective right and wrong will still find themselves slipping into a mode of thought where they do recognize good and evil. They'll find certain things atrocious and morally offensive, whether it's racism or the Nazi Holocaust or slavery or whatever it may be, they will find, or even just having their foot stepped on deliberately and maliciously in an elevator, they will find things that they find morally repugnant because that's just built into human nature. But people have free will, and so as a result, if they choose to reject their own intuitions, they can do that, and some people do. But the good news is most people go with their intuitions and recognize that good and evil and dignity are real and that we can appeal to our moral sentiments as evidence for those things.
Okay, Connor?
Yes, sir. I was just wondering if you had any references that I could do my own research on?
Well, there are, in terms of dignity specifically, I don't know, but there is a considerable literature, especially in the evangelical world, of apologetics that deals with atheism, and one of the common themes in some of that literature is more the what's called the moral argument. There's actually more than one type of moral argument, but some versions of the moral argument for God's existence will touch on the same kinds of things that I just mentioned. So I would do some searching online for moral argument for God's existence and see what comes up.
Thanks, Connor. It's open forum today. Jimmy Akin, our guest, first hour. Second hour, Jim Blackburn will be here. You are welcome to call, whether you're Catholic or not. 888-318-7884. Hey, we've got that new rewards program going over at shop.catholic.com, where pretty much everything you do over there earns you points you can cash in for great Catholic resources. You get points every time you shop, when you sign up for an account, when you do a review, when you refer a friend. There's 10 different ways to earn points in all, and it's so easy. Just visit shop.catholic.com/rewards today.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio with Matthew Bunsen. Join us every week as we talk with the Register's expert writers and editors about the news you need to know, and offer authentic Catholic insights on the important stories that impact your life. Register Radio, every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern and Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern, here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Whole bunch of lines open. I think we might have convinced people not to call this week because our phones kept going down. But you're welcome to call. There are actually five lines open right now. So if you've got a question for Jimmy Akin, it's open for him. And if you've had that experience of, oh, I never get through, well, now's your chance. You can get through. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. We head up to Toronto, Canada now, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Liz in Toronto, Canada, you are next. Go ahead, Liz, with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Dr. Akin. I had three questions relating to purgatory. The first one is purgatory mentioned in the Bible? The second one is, in any of Our Lady's apparitions, did she ask us to pray for the poor souls in purgatory? Or is this something that the Church has come up with? And my third question is, when we die, are we judged immediately for heaven, hell, or is there a third state, purgatory?
Okay. All right, okay. Thanks.
So purgatory is not mentioned by name in the Bible. The term purgatory comes from a Latin term, purgatorio, which would mean place of purification. And that's a theological term. It was developed later in church history after the time of the Bible. And in that respect, it's not unusual. There are a lot of theological terms that we don't find in the Bible that nevertheless refer to biblical realities. Examples besides purgatory include things like Trinity. You know, the Trinity is a biblical teaching, but it took a while for the church to come up with the name Trinity to refer to the different pieces of the doctrine that are in different passages in the Bible. Another like that is original sin. Original sin isn't mentioned by name in the Bible because the term came later, but the concept of original sin is in the Bible. And that's basically what we find with purgatory. If you look in the second book of Maccabees, there's a passage that indicates it is a noble thing to pray for the dead so that they could be freed from the consequences of their sins. And that is basically what we do when we ask God to help the souls in purgatory. St. Paul also mentions that even those who are saved, who are going to go to heaven, will find their works tested by fire, and it may not be a pleasant experience. He talks about that in 1 Corinthians 3. And so we find aspects of the doctrine of purgatory referred to in Scripture, but it took a while for the church to come up with that name. In terms of, is there a third destiny after death, which is purgatory? The answer is no. There are only two destinies. One of them is heaven, and one of them is hell. If someone goes to purgatory, it is a temporary thing. It's simply the final purification. Remember, that's what purgatory means, place or state of purification. It's the final purification that gets us ready to go to heaven. So everyone who goes to purgatory goes to heaven. It is not a third state. In terms of the first question you asked, have any apparitions of Our Lady requested prayers for the souls in purgatory? I'm certain that the answer to that is yes. However, the church also wants us to do that. It talks about it in the catechism. So the idea that we should pray for people in purgatory is not simply something that comes to us from private revelation. It's something that is actually part of church teaching. Private revelations, you know, like Our Lady of Fatima or Our Lady of Knock or so forth, because they're private revelations, they're not binding, they're not mandatory part of Catholic doctrine. But the idea that we should pray for people in purgatory is because the idea itself has biblical roots. As I mentioned at the beginning of this answer, it's all the way back in the Old Testament in 2 Maccabees that it's a noble thing to pray for the dead so that they can be freed from the consequences of their sins.
Liz, thank you so much. Appreciate that call from Canada, and call back anytime. I'm going to keep moving. Now, of course, the lines are full. They've filled back up. So let's go to Joseph in Tulsa, Oklahoma, watching on Facebook. Joseph, thanks for joining us. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
I've read a lot about the life of the saints, and I've watched several movies about our saints bilocating, being in one place and then needing to be someplace else. In fact, there was one about a nun who was bringing the rosary to the Native Americans here in the United States while she was in Europe, and her sisters giving her rosaries, and she actually distributed them to them. But then I hear somebody on the radio talking about things that we should never do, a Ouija board and astral projection.
Okay. So you want to know the relationship between bilocation and astral projection?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, there's no settled answer on this question. It involves aspects of mystical theology, you know, where we have bilocation discussed, and it involves aspects of parapsychology, where we have astral projection discussed. And so what I can do is kind of describe some of the thoughts that people have had on this subject, but I can't give you a definitive answer. In mystical theology, there is a recognition that, and in sacramental theology, there's a recognition that bilocation, or being in two places at once, or even multilocation, being in many places at once, is possible. That, for example, is how Jesus's body manages to be in all of the different Eucharists being celebrated all over the world. He multilocates. His body is in many places at once. But you'll notice his body is not manifested. I mean, you don't, in the Eucharist, you don't look at it and see a human form. You know, he's not 6 feet tall and sitting on the altar and, you know, swinging his legs or anything like that. You don't see a functioning human body there. And so there is a question among Catholic theologians historically about whether it would be possible for a single body to be manifested in more than one place, or does multilocation work by just having like the essence of the body present in a place even though it's not manifested? And there's a difference of opinion there. Some Catholic theologians historically have said, yeah, there's no problem. Miraculously, if God wants, he could have Jesus's body in many places at once manifesting itself. So you would see Jesus in every place. You could walk up and touch him, and it would really be his physical body appearing in more than one place. Other theologians, and Aquinas is actually in this category, would say that's not how it works. They don't think that's possible. Instead, they will say that God miraculously allows the substance or essence of Jesus's body to be in more than one place at a time, but it is not able to manifest. Then they have a fancy term for it that I'm avoiding just to keep things from getting technical. It's not capable of manifesting itself in more than one place. The place it is manifest is in heaven. Then we have similar phenomena that are reported among the saints, where you have saints who are at one extreme said to be seen in a second location. So people claim to be able to see them in a second location. A step back from that is not seeing the saint, but feeling the saint's presence. You know, I can feel that Padre Pio is with us in this room, even though we don't see him. Some people reported that back when Padre Pio was alive. Then from the perspective of the saint in question, they appear to have their point of view shifted away from their physical location. So let's say St. Padre Pio is in his cell back in his monastery, but his point of view will shift to some other location. And at times he would claim to have his point of view shift to the point that he was in America and was seeing things in America. Whether other people saw him or not, he claimed to be experiencing things in America, and then in a flash, he could be back in his cell. And so this is an instance where, based on his experience, his point of view had shifted, and he was not aware of his body back in his cell. And that it sounds very much like what some in the parapsychological community refer to as an out-of-body experience, where your point of view is no longer attached to your body, it's somewhere else, and you're not aware of your body. Then there is a step back from that in the parapsychological community. There are states that are not out of body, but are called bilocation by some parapsychologists. This happens, for example, in the remote viewing community. There is a kind of remote viewing, and remote viewing is supposed to be the ability to pick up information about a distant site. That's why it's called remote. But there is a kind of remote viewing called extended remote viewing, where a person basically relaxes and starts experiencing what it's like to be at a distant location, but they don't lose contact with their body. They're still aware of their body. They're still able to talk, but they're also having a vivid experience of another place. And that seems to be kind of a step back from the out-of-body experience, or the kind of experience Padre Pio had, where he would be at a distant place and not be conscious of his body. Then finally, there are other forms of remote viewing that are not as intense as extended remote viewing, where you're sitting at a desk or something and you're picking up information about some distant site, but it's not an immersive experience. Your point of view has not shifted away from your body. And so there's kind of a spectrum here, and it covers both parapsychological experiences and mystical experiences. And the truth is, we don't know how this all relates. You know, some of these experiences may or may not actually occur. Obviously, God's omnipotent, so he can allow these things to occur if he wants. And it's not clear, you know, assuming these things do occur, it's not clear what's causing them. It could be that God is allowing these things to happen by special supernatural grace. On the other hand, there have been Catholic theologians who have suggested that abilities like this are things God built into human nature, that they're part of our spirits. And if we had not fallen into sin, these experiences might be ordinary for us. But because of the fall into sin, these experiences are extraordinary now. They're not things that we can do regularly or easily. And so there's a range of views on all of this, and the church does not have a settled teaching about how all this works. It's a matter of theological speculation and parapsychological speculation.
Joseph, thanks very much. I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very much for the question. It's open forum. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884 with your question. And we go now back to Canada, in St. Albert's, Canada. Cass, listening on the Catholic Answers website, thecatholic.com. Cass, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, hello, Jimmy. My question is regarding the extraordinary Eucharistic ministers. In a parish where I attend, there's a tendency, I guess it's a practice, I suppose, now, where the Eucharistic ministers will approach the tabernacle and retrieve the Holy Communion to be distributed. So while the priest does the This is the Lamb of God prayers, and that's when the Eucharistic minister will approach the tabernacle and retrieve the rest of
Cass,
the...
Cass, we're getting right up to the end here, so what you want to know if that's okay for that, for the...
If that's okay, yeah. If it's an abuse or if there is, if it's a minor perception... And
It's been a while, it's been a while since I've looked at the texts on this. There are texts the church has of liturgical law that deal with this kind of question, and it's been a while since I've looked at them, but my memory and impression is that that is permitted.
Okay. Cass, I'm going to leave it there. I hope that that's helpful to you. Thank you very, very much. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. You are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Please don't forget, when you get the opportunity, to check out our podcast. We've got Trent Horn. He's got his Council of Trent. You can find that at trenthornpodcast.com. And you can find our podcast that we do here in this little old studio. It's called Catholic Answers Focus. And there's a new one up just yesterday on Christian architecture. You can find that at CatholicAnswersFocus.com. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with our guest, Jimmy Akin, on Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Hi, this is Janet Williams. You don't have to be a woman to enjoy Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
That confirms that it's Thursday. Jimmy Akin is here because that's a little bit of groovy music. Glad to have that groovy music. Jimmy, did you notice when you went up to the podium to speak at the conference that they played the Weird Questions music for you?
Well, they did during part of it when we were having the mysterious malfunction.
Oh, yeah. I thought they played it when you were growing up, too. So that's actually probably good that we had the mysterious malfunction so that they could play it.
They might have. I didn't notice that part. I was focused on what you were saying and getting up there in time.
Yeah.
You were talking about the conference we just had this last weekend here in San Diego, the annual Catholic Answers Conference. This time it was themed around Jesus Christ. It was called Who Do You Say That I Am? And to almost close out the conference, I actually answered that question for people.
You did indeed. And people appreciated it. Let's go now to Rebecca in Nebraska watching on YouTube. Rebecca, we're happy to have you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. I was just wondering, Saint Therese I got an email from Holy Heroes today saying that St. Therese died on September 30th. So, but I was like, I was thinking to myself, that doesn't sound right. Anyway, so yeah, she died on September 30th. So I'm wondering why the church celebrates her feast day on October 1st.
Well, so the answer is because that's the way the liturgical calendar grew up. Now, there is a little bit more I can say about that, but not a whole lot. Sometimes saints have the day a saint is commemorated on the calendar doesn't have a readily discernible reason. I'll take you at your word, because I haven't looked it up, but I'll take you at your word that she died on September 30th and her feast is on October 31st. Assuming that's the case, I would assume that the reason that her liturgical commemoration is the day after she died is because at the time there may have been some other factor that they wanted to keep September 30th open for. Either another saint already had something that day, or there's something that could potentially fall on that day. And as a result, they ended up moving it by one day in order to keep that day free. There are other possibilities, but that's a phenomenon that I know does happen, where even though a person died on one day, they may not get their liturgical commemoration on the day of their death because there's something else that's happening on that day. So they put their liturgical commemoration on a different day in the year so the two things don't clash.
Rebecca, thanks. Thanks very much. I hope that was helpful to you. It's open forum. You can ask whatever you like about the Catholic faith, about religion in general, about morals, philosophy, science. Ask whatever you like. 888-318-7884. We go to Sue in northern Wisconsin, listening on EWTN. Sue, go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin. No, Sue? All right, I'm going to come right back to you, Sue. Hang on. We're going to come back to you. When you realize that we were on the air, we'll come back to you. We'll go now to Henry in San Antonio, Texas, listening on 89.7 FM KGMA. Henry, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Si. Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, happy to, Henry.
So my question is about whether one can plan a trip or even a lifetime that would take one away from the sacraments. And I'm thinking particularly about explorers and pioneers who did this. Is that okay?
Well, it depends on the situation. There are cases where someone may need to move away from a particular place, even though it means they're going to be deprived of the sacraments for an extended period of time, or potentially, you know, even indefinitely, and that may turn out to be the rest of their lives. For example, if you're a Christian in a particular town and a persecution starts and you have to flee in order to save your life, which is one of the things you need to do, that may mean being away from the sacraments for an extended period, and you may not get back to them. There have been situations like, for example, in Japan, after the Jesuits were expelled from Japan, the Japanese Christians didn't have any access to the sacraments, but it was not obligatory on them to, like, try to swim away from Japan to some other land where they would have access to the sacraments. That would be a heroic action, and I'm not aware of anybody who did that, but if they did, it would be heroic, but it would not be obligatory. In the 1600s, to uproot yourself and get out of Japan and go to a whole new land and learn a new language, and it would be an extremely difficult thing to do, and it wouldn't be obligatory. So that illustrates that there are situations where we don't have to do things that are gravely difficult in order to gain access to the sacraments. But there are costs to doing that. Namely, you don't have the sacraments in that case. And if you don't have, for example, regular access to confession when you need it, you're taking a risk and, you know, not having the grace that the other sacraments provide as well. You're taking a risk with your spiritual state. It is riskier to not have access to the sacraments. Now, there are things you can do when, through no fault of your own, you're not able to receive the sacraments. You can, for example, make an act of perfect contrition with the intention of going to confession, should it be possible at some future point to go to confession, and you can be restored to grace in that way. And if, and that kind of thing would be obligatory. If you didn't have access to the sacraments and you had committed a mortal sin and you were getting ready to die, you would need to make an act of perfect contrition in order to be restored to God's grace in that state. That would be a positive obligation. And because of the risk that's involved in this kind of situation, when there were pioneers and explorers, they tended, in the age of exploration, they tended to take their priests with them. So, for example, when the conquistadors came over from Spain, they brought priests with them. And the priests would both tend to the spiritual needs of the conquistadors, they would give them the sacraments, and they would also evangelize in the New World. And so the church and exploration and pioneering has tended to go hand in hand. Where I'm from, or where I grew up in Arkansas, there is a little town right near my hometown called Tontytown. And it had been founded by Catholic immigrants who, when they were moving out to the frontier and they weren't going to be around an established location, they brought priests with them, and it founded a little bitty Catholic town on the frontier. And so that kind of thing, while it's possible to have situations where people are not going to be able to receive the sacraments for lengthy periods of time, it is not desirable. And so the church has tended to move with waves of exploration and colonization and pioneering and so forth. And I expect the same thing will happen in the next age of exploration. When we start colonizing Mars in a few years, at least that's what's planned, I expect that there will be Catholic priests on Mars not too long after general people have gotten there and started building, you know, bases.
Henry, thanks. Thanks very much for the question. We couldn't get Sue before, but we've got Sue back. So we're going to go to Sue in northern Wisconsin, listening on EWTN. Sue, thank you for your call. Go ahead, please, with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Thanks so much, Jimmy. Can you please explain briefly just the differentiate particular versus general judgment, number one, and then secondly, with respect to out-of-body experiences, but
near-death experiences?
Life after death experiences. Yeah, mm-hmm. That there's no one. People don't talk about. They make it sound like, you know, it's all hunky dory, and you die, and then you see this great light, and there's all this love, but you know, Jesus says that, you know. Yeah. There, you will be judged. So
all right.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to be reflected in the near-death experiences.
Right, Sue. Thanks.
So we don't have a great deal of information about the specific differences between the particular judgment and the general judgment. We do know that one difference is that at the particular judgment, we don't have our bodies with us, whereas at the general judgment, we do have our bodies with us because at that point, we've been raised from the dead. Another difference that at least appears to be the case is that the particular judgment may be a more private experience. It may not be public in the way the general judgment is. We do have this passage from Jesus where he talks about what we've done, what we've whispered in the darkness is going to be shouted from the housetops. And that suggests that a future judgment experience, at least the general judgment, is going to be public so that people will see God's justice and mercy and how those played out in the lives of everybody. However, it's possible the same thing could happen with the particular judgment. It's just people in the afterlife are the ones who are aware of it, and we're not aware of it in this life. So it's possible they both have this public dimension. Also, the relationship between purgatory is and the two judgments is not clear. Purgatory may or may not take time. And so, according to some views, it happens in a way that our earthly time can't measure, and it may coincide with the particular judgment. So this is an idea that Pope Benedict XVI explored in his encyclical on Christian hope, Spes Salvi, where he pointed out that some theologians, including himself, have speculated that the fire of purgatory is a transforming encounter with the love of Christ. And so in the act of being judged, of meeting Jesus at the particular judgment, you would be transformed by the fire of his love. And the same thing for those who are still alive could happen at the general judgment. So that's also a matter of speculation. If you need purgation, if you need purification, that's also something that could happen at the general judgment. In terms of near-death experiences, I have an episode of Mysterious World where I talk about those, and I talk about this issue. So you might go back and listen to that. But briefly, actually there are cases of near-death experiences where someone comes back and says, I got a wake-up call. I have not been living the way I should. And some of them will come back and say, I did not have a good time. I experienced something that was very unpleasant, and I'm very glad I got to come back, and it was a wake-up call to me. In fact, I know within my own family, one of my distant relations had a near-death experience where he had not been living the way he should, and he came back and said, I'm very thankful I got to come back because I had not been living the way I should, and I'm fixing that. So there actually are cases where people do come back and report that everything wasn't just hunky-dory, that they did experience something that was not pleasant or not fully pleasant, and they realized they need to change the way they were living. Now, that's not the majority of people who come back, and you could speculate, why is that the case? One possibility is God's grace may reach more people today than we would suspect. Another possibility is it's the people who are in a state of grace that are the ones that get to come back. Maybe there are other people who are not in a state of grace, and they're not given the opportunity to come back, because that's a grace. If you die and you're not in a state of grace, getting to come back and revisit that situation and address it, that would be an enormous gift that you don't have a right to. And so it could be that people who are experiencing severe forms of judgment may not be the ones who are allowed to come back after a near-death experience. So we can't really know the answer here, but it is part of the near-death literature that people will report unpleasant experiences and talk about judgment.
Sue, thanks. We got to take our break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
I was listening to the EWTN, and you were on with one of your little snippets, and you said some words that brought me back to the church. I've been away for a long time. You don't know how much I appreciate those words, and I don't know why those particular words that day got to me.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Open Forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Second hour, Jim Blackburn will be here with us. This hour, Jimmy Akin is here taking your calls. And we go now to Stanton, Ohio. Matt in Stanton, Ohio, listening on Living Bread Radio. You are up next. Go ahead, Matt.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a convert. I was attending school for pastoral ministry. one of my professors had stated that the pre-exilic Jews actually didn't believe in a monotheistic God, but they worship the henotheistic God, the belief of a supreme deity, but not denying the existence of other gods. And he cited, that the word Elohim, the plurality, they had no knowledge of the Trinity. It meant to counsel the gods of Canaan. He cites Psalm 82 when it says, God stood in the midst of the assembly of the gods and rendered judgment. Also, where Satan and Job has to present himself in this assembly of these sons of God or these Elohim. And I was wondering if you could comment on that and tell me if there is any kind of teaching that the Catholic Church views concerning that.
Okay, so we got several issues there that we need to address. The first one is, what is henotheism? And people are familiar with monotheism, which is the belief that there is only one God. Henotheism is a little bit different. Now, the common alternatives that people are aware of to monotheism are atheism, which says there's no gods, and polytheism, which says there's many gods. Well, henotheism is sort of like monotheism and sort of like polytheism. The basic idea is that, okay, maybe there are multiple gods of some sort, but there's one God that we should worship. And hen is a Greek term that means one. So henotheism is a kind of one godism, but it's different than monotheism in that it doesn't deny that there are or may be other deities, but there is one that we should worship. And in the case of the Jewish people, well, they have the one God, Yahweh, who's made a covenant with them. He is their God. They are his people. They should worship only him. Whatever else is out there, they shouldn't be worshiping it. Now, it's true that you have some Jews in the before the exile and even after the exile, but before the exile, who you could say were henotheists. But you also had some Jews who were polytheists, because that's one of the things the prophets are constantly complaining about, is you've got Jews who are worshiping gods like Baal and Asherah and Anat and goat idols from Egypt and things like that. And so there were Jews who were flat-out polytheists. What you have is a range of different views among Jews, not all of which are Orthodox. And so, yeah, some of them were henotheistic, and it's a matter of debate how many of them there were. There are passages you can point to in the Old Testament that you could use to try to argue something more like henotheism. You mentioned Psalm 82, where God stands up in the council of the gods. Job, I don't think, is a good example, because in Job, also, by the way, you mentioned the word Elohim. Yes, Elohim is plural in form in Hebrew, and it can refer to multiple gods, but it also frequently functions as a singular noun, where it is a name for the one true God. And you can show that in the grammar. It is absolutely unambiguous. It's kind of like, Saikelet, in English, we have some words that don't change their form based on whether they're singular or plural, like sheep.
Yeah, right. We don't have sheep.
If I'm talking... Yeah, we don't have sheeps. So but I can still tell, or you could still tell, how I'm using the word sheep based on the words around it.
Yeah.
If I say the sheep is eating the grass, how many sheep am I talking about? The sheep is.
Yeah, there's just one sheep.
But if I say the sheep are eating the grass, how many am I talking about?
A million. Well, somewhere between two and infinity.
Okay, so we can tell based on the form of the verb how many sheep I'm talking about. Same thing with pronouns. If I say the sheep, he is happy.
Yeah.
How many sheep is it?
That's just one sheep.
Because of the he. But if I say the sheep, they are happy.
That's more sheeps.
more sheep. So it's plural. And so based on the verbs and the pronouns, we can tell whether sheep is functioning as a singular or plural. The same thing is true of Elohim. And if you look, for example, in Genesis 1, in the creation narrative, even though the word Elohim is used, the verbs and pronouns are singular. And that shows us that Elohim in this passage is being used as a single term for a single God who is the creator. Now, also, notice he's the creator. That makes him different and more powerful than any other spiritual being that may exist, because nobody else created the world. He made everything that exists. And so if there are other spiritual powers, they would be created beings, not the uncreated God. And so already in the Old Testament, you have an awareness that Yahweh is different and superior than any other God. And so when we then read about, like, the sons of God in Job, they are clearly subordinate to and inferior to Yahweh, the true God, and today we would classify them as angels. They are the angelic princes. And in Deuteronomy, it talks about how God numbered the nations according to the number of the sons of God. Based on this and other passages, like in Daniel, we see that God has put his angelic princes in charge of different nations. So Michael is the angelic prince who's in charge of Israel. We also read in Daniel about the prince of Greece and the prince of Persia. And some of these have gone bad. And we notice, for example, in Daniel, the prince of Persia has been resisting Gabriel and Michael. And so that shows that some of these angelic princes that have been put in charge of other nations have gone bad and are resisting God's will. And the ancient Hebrew understanding, and including in the New Testament era, is that that's one of the places that demons come from, that they are these fallen angelic princes that were put over other nations, but then started encouraging the people of those nations to worship them. And you could call them gods in the ancient vocabulary. You could call them angels in the modern vocabulary. But either way, they're recognized as lesser, finite, subordinate, created spirits that are of a fundamentally different category than Yahweh, the infinite, uncreated, ultimate God. And so whether you want to call this monotheism or henotheism becomes more of a semantic issue, because the Hebrews recognized that the one true God, Yahweh, is uncreated and superior to everything else. Any other spiritual being, whether you want to call it a god or an angel or whatever it may be, is finite and created and of a wholly different category than Yahweh. So it really depends if you want to, if you can apply the term monotheism, if by God you mean an uncreated being, well, then the Jews were definitely monotheists. They believed there was only one uncreated being. If, on the other hand, by God you just mean a spiritual being that's more powerful than humans, well, then you could describe the Orthodox Jewish faith before the time of Christ as henotheism, because they believed, yeah, there are multiple created but finite spiritual beings that are more powerful than us, like angels, but we should still only be worshiping Yahweh, the ultimate God. If you'd like more on all that, there's an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World called God and the Gods, where I'm able to go into that in more detail and work through these various passages.
Okay, Matt?
Wonderful. Thank you guys so much. I'm so blessed by your program. Thank you.
Well, thank you very, very much. And I hope you will check out Jimmy's episode on God or the Gods at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy, that brings us all the way right up to the end of the show. Thanks for a really great hour.
Hey, my pleasure.
If you missed last week's episode, you can see Jimmy get his psychic abilities tested on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. A new episode drops each Friday morning, so tomorrow morning, check it out, see what's new. Coming up next, we're going to continue with Open Forum. You are welcome to call. I'll just let you know there's only one line open at the moment, 888-318-7884. Jim Blackburn is going to be our guest. Jim, a longtime member of the Catholic Answers family. Now also, he's got a second family. Well, I shouldn't say it that way, I guess. He's got a second thing he's doing called Catholic Questions. We'll ask him about that when we come back, and we'll take lots and lots of your questions right after this on Catholic Answers Live.